The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Mary Grace Payden for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Religion in the News. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from the Religion News Service and the Associated Press. First of all, an article from the Religion News Service published on the 24th of January, entitled Multi-Faith Leaders Urge Unity, an Aftermath of Monterey Park Shooting That Left 11 Dead, by Alejandra Molina, Monterey Park, California. The pews at St. Stephen Martyr Catholic Church were emptier than usual on the morning of January 22nd, as news spread that a gunman responsible for killing 11 people at a nearby Monterey Park dance studio remained at large. Star Ballroom Dance Studio, where 72-year-old Hu Khan Tran opened fire, is less than half a mile from the church, and some parishioners skipped Mass out of fear the gunman might pop up in a place where a lot of us are congregating, said the Reverend Joseph Maidong, who pastors St. Stephen Martyr. In response to the shooting, Magdeong planned a special Mass for January 27th to pray for the victims and for all of us to be strong and to have faith that we need to be able to heal and make sense of this tragedy. Magdeong was among the Christian and Jewish leaders who attended a candlelight vigil on January the 23rd at Monterey Park City Hall to accompany residents as they mourned the 11 slain victims who were in their 50s, 60s, and 70s. The death toll rose to 11 on January the 23rd after one of the people who was wounded died. Magdeong said that it was important to be there to represent his parish, which serves as a hub for Indonesians in the area, and to make a statement that the Catholic Church is also one with the community. Monterey Park in Los Angeles County's San Gabriel Valley is regarded as America's first suburban Chinatown. Magdeong led attendees in a prayer on January 23rd and said his church, which will be hosting rosary services for the victims, would also be praying for the gunman to be able to put this into something positive. Elected leaders, including Representative Judy Chu and Tarrant's Mayor George Chen, were at the vigil. The gunman died of a self-inflicted wound in a strip mall parking lot in Tarrant's, a city about 25 miles south of Monterey Park. This community is resilient, Chu said. A makeshift vigil grew outside throughout the night as residents placed votive candles, flowers, and balloons outside City Hall. 11 white stands representing the fatal victims stood along the vigil. Most were unmarked, as only 4 of the victims, Min Yan, 65, Lilan Li, 63, Zhu Wan Yu, 57, and Valentino Elvera, 68, had been identified. Inscribed on the stands was Bible verse Matthew 5, 4. Blessed are those who mourn, for they shall be comforted. We never thought it that it would be one of us, and it's so shocking, we can't accept it, Ann Lau, an organizer of the vigil, told reporters. A couple of activists held a red sign that read, "The problem is guns," and yelled that they needed more than just prayers. Rabbi Lynn Moroff spoke at the vigil, telling residents that the Jewish community is standing at your side. "I wish it was the first time that I was speaking to a group where there was a tragedy, but a few years ago, when the Mother Emmanuel AME Church in South Carolina was pulling people together after the shootings, I said then what I say now in terms of offering support from the Jewish community, that we are all created in God's image," Muroff said. "We have to work hard to bring about the peace and quiet and the repair to broken hearts for other people, the same way that we do it for our own," Muroff added. Rabbi Ralph Resnick spoke of his ties to the San Gabriel Valley, where he grew up in Pasadena and attended Hebrew school in the city of Alhambra, adjacent to Monterey Park. Resnick leads services at a congregation in nearby West Covina. Resnick urged solidarity among the different ethnicities and religions represented at the vigil. "I can safely say that every single one of us came from someplace else. But we all came to be here together because this was a land that would accept all of us. And it's so sad that at this time, the event that brought us together might separate us," he said. "You must love your neighbor as yourself," Resnick added. "You can see every color, every religion, every belief system gathered here together, because we're here together to make sure that this never happens again." To Chuching Wang, who helped organize the vigil, it was deeply moving to see people of different ethnicities and religions unite in the aftermath of the shooting that struck the Chinese-American community. Wang appreciated the Spanish-speaking residents who were there and said it was the first time he connected with Jewish leaders. "That gave me more confidence among the community," Wang said. "Hopefully we can all come together to overcome the fear and can cope with tragedy much better. It feels like one big family," he said. A group of clergy from nearby Pasadena also descended to Monterey Park to pray with residents and city leaders. Known as the Clergy Community Coalition, the group has been active in rent control advocacy and policing justice issues in Pasadena, where a controversial fatal police shooting killed 32-year-old Anthony McLean in 2020. Pastor John Lowe of Epicenter Church in Pasadena said the church has learned over time that when tragedy happens, the church has to be there. We have to be there to cry with people. We have to be there to lament. We have to be there to say, "We're sorry. Things have to be better," Lowe said. From the Associated Press on January the 22nd, an article entitled, "Lutherans Ordain First Palestinian Woman Pastor in Holy Land, Jerusalem." A Lutheran church ceremony in Jerusalem ordained the first Palestinian female pastor in the Holy Land. Sally Azar will head the English-speaking congregation at the Church of the Redeemer, the Evangelical Lutheran Church in Jordan and the Holy Land. Her ordination was held before a packed crowd inside the church in Jerusalem's Old City. The West Bank and Gaza Strip were home to around 47,000 Christians as of 2017, according to the Palestinian Central Bureau of Statistics. Most Palestinian Christians belong to denominations that do not allow female clergy. A very small minority belong to Protestant congregations that do have women as ministers. The Evangelical Lutheran Church says it has around 3,000 adherents in Jerusalem, the West Bank, and Jordan. Azar will be one of five ordained women in the Middle East, joining one in Syria and three in Lebanon, according to the Middle East Council of Churches. From the Religion News Service on the 23rd of January, an article by Emily McFarlane Miller entitled, "Faith-Based Organizations Urge Biden Not to Enact Asylum Ban." A number of faith-based organizations and congregations are pleading with the Biden administration in a letter sent on January the 23rd to President Joe Biden and other leaders not to enact new immigration restrictions. The letter, signed by 165 faith-based local, national, and international organizations and congregations, expresses grave concern with policies Biden announced earlier in January. While those policies expand a program offering humanitarian parole to Venezuelans to include individuals from Nicaragua, Haiti, and Cuba, they also include a proposal to bar people from seeking asylum if they enter the U.S. without inspection or do not seek protection in other countries along the way, the letter said. The administration has said it plans to launch an app that individuals can use to schedule an appointment for inspection instead of coming directly to a U.S. port of authority in order to reduce wait times and crowds at the border. The letter urges the Biden administration not to move forward with what it calls an asylum ban, calling it harmful, inhumane, and deadly for the most vulnerable. Across faith traditions and practices, the message is clear. We are called by our sacred text and faith principles to approach one another with love, not fear, the letter reads. Our diverse faith traditions compel us to love our neighbor, accompany the vulnerable, and welcome the sojourner, regardless of place of birth, religion, or ethnicity. Importantly, our faiths also urge us to boldly resist and dismantle systems of oppression. Parole is no substitute for access to asylum, according to the letter. Signers included three of the six faith-based agencies that partner with U.S. government to resettle refugees: Church World Service, HIAS, formerly the Hebrew Immigrant Aid Society, and Lutheran Immigration and Refugee Service. Several denominations also signed on to the letter, including the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America, Presbyterian Church, USA, and United Church of Christ. Other signers are the American Friends Service Committee, General Board of Global Ministries, and General Board of Church and Society of the United Methodist Church, Hindus for Human Rights, Anti-Defamation League, Christian Reformed Church Office of Social Justice, Mennonite Central Committee, U.S., National Council of Churches, Network Lobby for Catholic Social Justice, Union for Reformed Judaism, and Unitarian Universalists for Social Change. On a call hosted by the Interfaith Immigration Coalition and Welcome with Dignity campaign, Krish Omara Vignarashah, President and CEO of LIRS, shared a number of misconceptions people have about those seeking humanitarian aid. Not all have valid passports, access to a cell phone, reliable Wi-Fi, or a willing sponsor in the U.S. in order to take advantage of pathways to enter the country, she said. For many, their best option is to make an often dangerous journey to the U.S. border to seek asylum. That is a high hurdle to clear, one that borders on a wealth test for some of the most vulnerable children and families facing immediate danger, she said. Mark Hetfield, president and CEO of HIAS, said his organization is old enough to remember a time before the U.S. had laws allowing people to seek asylum. Hetfield pointed to 1939, when he said the Franklin D. Roosevelt administration refused to allow a ship carrying 900 Jewish passengers who were fleeing Nazi Germany to dock in Florida. It returned to Europe, where 254 of those passengers perished in the Holocaust. That's why the United Nations established, and the U.S. adopted, the Refugee Convention, he said, asserting that never again would people be trapped inside of their country of persecution. The Biden administration's proposal would place the asylum laws the U.S. now has out of reach for many, Hetfield said, which he called illegal and immoral. And that hits home for many faith-based organizations who've been serving some of the most vulnerable for decades, Vignarajah said. This isn't charity for us. This is how our supporters live out their faith and answer that higher call to welcome the stranger in need. Now a piece from the Associated Press that was published on the 22nd of January and written by Mehmet Güzel, Turkish Muslims Protest Quran Burning in Sweden. Istanbul. Outrage over a Quran burning protest in Sweden produced a second day of protest in Turkey, reflecting tensions between the two countries. Some 250 people gathered outside the Swedish consulate in Istanbul, where a photo of Danish anti-Islam activist Rasmus Paludan was set on fire. Paludan burned Islam's holy book outside the Turkish embassy in Stockholm on January the 21st, sparking protests in both Istanbul and Ankara, that night. Participants in the January 22nd event carried green flags featuring the Islamic Proclamation of Faith and a banner that said, "We condemn Sweden's state-supported Islamophobia." A sign on a window of the Swedish consulate read, "We do not share that book-burning idiot's view." The protests have renewed concerns about Turkey holding up Sweden and Finland's bid to join NATO. Turkey has not yet ratified the Nordic nations' memberships in the military alliance, saying Sweden needs to address Ankara's security concerns. Turkish officials slammed Sweden for allowing the Quran-burning protest, but President Recep Tayyip Erdogan did not comment on it during his speeches. Swedish Prime Minister Ulf Kristersson tweeted that freedom of expression was crucial to democracy, but added that what is legal is not necessarily appropriate. Burning books that are holy to many is a deeply disrespectful act. I want to express my sympathy for all Muslims who are offended by what happened in Stockholm today, Kristersson said. Mustafa Demirkan, one of the people protesting in Istanbul on January the 22nd, said the act of burning the Quran should not be considered an act protected by the right of free expression. Protesters also gathered outside the Swedish embassy for a second day. In southeastern Sanlurfa province, men held the Quran high after prayers in a mosque and chanted, "God is great," in videos shared online. More protests were planned for that evening. Next, a piece published by the Religion News Service on the 20th of January, entitled, "New Book Spotlights Influence of Pentecostalism on California's Mexican Farm Workers," by Alejandra Molina. The farm labor history of California has often been told through the plight of agricultural laborers during the Depression era and the efforts beginning in the early 1960s of the United Farm Workers to improve working conditions of Mexicans in the field. But to Lord Barba, a professor of religion at Amherst College, this history isn't complete without factoring in religion, particularly the stories of California's Mexican farm workers who embraced Pentecostalism, a Christian movement generally seen at the time as a distasteful new sect with cultish and fanatical tendencies. I think about how often Latino history is told as labor history, and that makes sense. But where are the laborers going? Barbara said. If we're going to get a more balanced and accurate Latino history, we have to look at Latino religious life. In his recently released book, Sowing the Sacred, Mexican Pentecostal Farm Workers in California, Barbara writes about the Mexican and Mexican-American Pentecostal agricultural workers who built houses of worship in the state's agricultural towns, who turned to divine healing for injuries they sustained working in the fields, and whose worship style inspired civil rights leader Cesar Chavez to incorporate music and singing in his union organizing. Barbara also writes about the role of women in these church spaces, who were the foundation of the church, despite not giving ministerial credentials to become preachers. They raised money for the building of churches by selling food and made the worship spaces look holy through their handmade goods, such as doilies and fabric embroidered with biblical phrases, Barbara said. To do a material history of this Mexican Pentecostal movement is to do women's history, he told Religion News Service. The book traces the development of Pentecostalism among migrant laborers between 1916 and 1966, before the heyday of the National Farm Workers Association, which later became the United Farm Workers. Barbara felt it important to describe a moment when the exploitation of Mexican workers is at its worst. Barbara, in his book, recounts how divine healing was seen as a pragmatic way to care for impoverished workers who lacked regular access to medical care. For laborers working in tough conditions, it was about hard work and fervent worship, work by day and worship by night, Barbara said. People are getting hurt. People are contracting tuberculosis. People are seeking out healing when there's not a healthcare system in place to provide those kinds of services, Barbara said. Whether we're talking about physical healing or what we now refer to as mental health and counseling, these are spaces that offered respite in an otherwise punishing world. Worship services would call for people who were sick to come up and be healed, Barbara said. There was a spectacle side to it, he added, and that it was a very public kind of ritual. In the book, Barbara cites a flyer distributed by La Iglesia Apostolica Cristianita del Pentecoste that invited residents in the imperial county city of Calexico to revival services held under the direction of the Holy Spirit. These services were outdoor and presided by a Mexican orator and pastor who lived in Los Angeles. All are invited, bring your sick, and God will bless them, the flyer declared. Barbara writes about the sonic elements of services, which included collective singing, exuberant worshiping, guitar playing, percussive striking, hand clapping, and shouting Alleluia. The vibrancy of this sacred music inspired Chavez to later incorporate it into his organizational tactics. Barbara wrote of the working relationship between Chavez, who at the time served with the Community Service Organization, and the Reverend Mariano Marin, a Pentecostal preacher and pastor, who led his immigrant congregation in the midst of Operation Wetback, which resulted in a mass deportation of Mexican nationals. Through this partnership, Chavez witnessed Marin leading worship services out of a house in the San Joaquin Valley, town of Madera, and noticed a contrast between the sonic and material world of Pentecostal and Catholic music, Barbara wrote. Chavez recalled in his 1975 autobiography visiting a little church in Madera of a dozen men and women, describing more spirit there than when I went to Mass when there were 200. These people were really committed in their beliefs, and this made them sing and clap and participate. I like that, Chavez wrote. I think that's where I got the idea of singing at the meetings. That was one of the first things we did when I started the union. And it was hard for me because I couldn't carry a tune. For Barbara, who hails from Stockton in the Central Valley, it's noteworthy that this religious movement began in rural agricultural areas. He sees the influence of those early immigrant houses of worship today in the Spanish language churches across California's Central Valley. A church that used to be First Baptist Church in many cities in the Central Valley may now be Iglesia Bautista, Barber said, adding that he also knows of church services in Mixtec among indigenous Mexicans arriving in the area. Because of a large, first Mexican but now more so Central American influx into the agricultural fields in California, you can note a very visible transformation of the religious demography, Barber said. Last of all, a piece from the Associated Press, published on the 23rd of January, entitled Church of England Apologizes for Treatment of LGBTQ People, by Danica Kirka, London. The Church of England formally apologized on January the 20th for its treatment of LGBTQ people, even as it said the same-sex couple still will not be allowed to marry in its churches. The apology from the church's bishops came in a report following 5 years of debate on the church's position on sexuality. The report will be delivered to the church's National Assembly, the General Synod, which is meeting in London in February. We want to apologize for the ways in which the Church of England has treated LGBTQ people, both those who worship in our churches and those who do not, the bishop said in a statement. For the times we have rejected or excluded you and those you love, we are deeply sorry. The occasions on which you have received a hostile and homophobic response in our churches are shameful, and for this we repent. Nonetheless, the Church of England's stance that matrimony is restricted to unions between one man and one woman will remain in place. It has instead proposed offering same-sex couples the chance to have a church service with prayers of dedication, thanksgiving, or for God's blessing after they have a civil wedding or register a civil partnership. Same-sex marriage has been legal in England and Wales since 2013, but the church did not change its teaching when the law changed. Church leaders described the decision on church services as a significant change that acknowledges the lived experience of some faithful Christians. But deep divisions remain, and the bishops acknowledge that some clergy will choose not to use the new prayers to bless the unions of same-sex couples. Among them will be Archbishop of Canterbury, Justin Welby, the spiritual leader of the Anglican Church. He described the introduction of the prayers as a moment of joy and celebration, but said that his role in the Anglican community makes his primary task to work for unity among some 85 million members. Because of my pastoral care and responsibility of being a focus of unity for the whole communion, I will not personally use them in order not to compromise that pastoral care, he told reporters. Jane Ozane, a prominent campaigner for LGBTQ people in the church, expressed disappointment with the stand of the bishops, arguing that God did not discriminate, and neither should we. We've had apology after apology after apology, and this one, frankly, sounds hollow and cruel, Ozane wrote on Twitter. Because if you apologize and then carry on with the abuse, it is akin to domestic abuse. The fact that the bishops don't see that is what angers me. We have run out of time for today's episode of Religion in the News, so please listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Mary Grace Payden, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Religion in the News is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any questions or comments, please call us at 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.